Welcome back to the cryptographic communication protocols lecture. Last week, we had a final look at theoretical concepts that are relevant to understand what modern messengers are doing. And for this, we added our focus on what possible threat vectors are, what attackers could do, and what we want to prevent against and protect the security of our communication against by looking at weak randomness. And we identified a building block that allows us to strengthen our protocols against that threat, which was the so-called key updatable key encapsulation mechanism, which is basically a key encapsulation mechanism in which public key and secret key can both be updated in a way such that the public key, when being updated, never reveals any information about future or past keys that are established by the key encapsulation mechanism. And also the secret key, when being updated, offers some form of forward secrecy. And finally, the updates of the public keys and the secret keys need to stay in sync. So basically, when updating one of the two components, the update is fed with some associated data, and as long as the associated data stays in sync for both updates, the keys work compatible. But as soon as there is a difference between the update associated data, the keys become incompatible, and so future keys that are established with the public key will not be leaked to someone who has the secret key, which was updated incompatibly. The very naive construction of key updatable KEMs is based on hierarchical identity-based encryption. And we remembered that hierarchical identity-based encryption is pretty inefficient. The basic idea was that we have the tree of identities, and an update of the secret key is just a delegation to a lower level identity, and the update of the public key is just adding the associated data string to the strings of updates that happened so far. And that means that we have a very deep depth, an unbounded depth in the HIBE, which is not a property that we would like to have, because unbounded depth HIBEs are expensive. And so we looked at very, very briefly and sketched the idea of a different construction that just works with bounded depth HIBEs. And the idea is basically to split the updates into smaller strings of updates, or smaller lists of updates. And each of these lists is then called an epoch, and these epochs are arranged in a tree, similar to the idea of how forward secure key encapsulation mechanisms work. So we have a binary tree that has epochs, and these epochs somewhat, or this binary tree of epochs, is basically similar to how forward secure key encapsulation mechanisms work. But then in these epochs, we then have updates that are based on, or that pay attention to, the associated data strings with which we do updates. And so we basically combine these two ideas to have a much better, much more efficient form of key updatable key encapsulation mechanisms. As I said, these ideas are still very theoretical, because none of the messengers that we know in practice implements these things. And for us, it's more the idea of understanding what could be done, what are the tools that we have, where are the open problems, where are the open questions in the research literature. So one of the open problems is, for example, building a key encapsulation or key updatable key encapsulation mechanism from even more efficient building blocks, such that eventually we could use these things. But before we solve these problems, we first need to understand how the practical messengers actually look like. And this is the focus of today's lecture. So today we look at the double ratchet, algorithm, we look at group messaging in general. Because the double ratchet protocol or the double ratchet algorithm is a messaging protocol that is useful for two-party conversations. And if we would like to scale from two-party to group messaging, the first idea that comes to mind is that you just have pairwise channels between all group members, and so one group message becomes n single messages or n minus one messages sent from myself to the remaining group members. And this is inefficient. And because this is inefficient, there are several alternatives that could be used. And one of these alternatives is technically a little bit more challenging. And for that reason, we'd take a look deeper at that later in today's lecture, but also even more detailed in a slide variant or alternative next lecture, and this is the tree-based Diffie-Hellman. The tree-based Diffie-Hellman allows us to build a group messaging protocol with sublinear communication overhead. Okay, we will see more about that at the end of the lecture, as I said, but it is pretty relevant in the sense that the tree-based Diffie-Hellman idea, in its variant that we will look at next week, has been standardized last year. Standardized for group messaging, the MLS messaging standard is something that is aimed to be deployed in big messengers, for example, in Cisco's WebEx. Also, Facebook and WhatsApp are doing some preliminary research on how to implement it or embed it in their systems. And so, all of these things that we talk about today and next week are really deployed in practice or will be deployed in practice with billions of users. Okay, so we start with the double ratchet algorithm. The double ratchet algorithm was originally called Axolotl. It was designed and developed by Trevor Perrin. You may notice or remember this name from the Noyce Protocol Framework, for which he is also the inventor. And if you look at the Noyce protocol framework, the ideas are somewhat similar. You will see that there are also somewhat updates of key material that help users when initiating a conversation to gain strong security guarantees. So Noyce is somewhat the initialization key exchange or channel establishment protocol that is indeed even often used to protect the messages that are encrypted with the double ratchet protocol. So we've been talking about Noyce when we saw that in WhatsApp, messages sent from Alice to Bob are first encrypted with the double ratchet protocol, and then from Alice to the server and from the server to Bob, the messages are encrypted with the Noyce framework. Okay. The second developer and inventor of the double ratchet is Moxie Marlinspike. And both of them developed this in 2013. So this is a pretty old protocol. It has been around for a while, for 11 years now. And it is still more or less in that form deployed and used in Signal and in WhatsApp. The primary idea was it was inspired by the OTR protocol, The OTR protocol is even much, much older, has been used in online messengers that didn't use any smartphone technology or anything. And the idea was that, so OTR had some properties that were designed for when being online and talking online to others, you can use it. But as soon as you would like to communicate via unreliable networks like SMS or smartphones that then use the internet, some changes were somewhat needed, but also some stronger security guarantees were desired. And this is the reason why the OTR protocol was then extended or modified by the double ratchet algorithm. There are two very important security analyses of this protocol. And even many more about components of the protocol or extensions of the protocol or further ideas. But the most important ones I've been mentioning in the lecture, in the exercise already, and that was the first one was by Congordon et al. And the title was a formal security analysis of the signal protocol or something similar. It was published at a smaller conference in 2017 and it has now been published in the Journal of Cryptography, Cryptology, which is the main journal of our community. And the focus there was, just as a quick reminder, I probably have been talking about it before, the focus of this first analysis was looking at all components that are part of starting a secure communication and then establishing a secure communication with the double ratchet protocol. And this starts with the X3DH protocol, first establishing a key and then using that key in the double ratchet to continuously update that. And so if one would like to draw something like how the security analysis was, then imagine this here is the double ratchet protocol, just an abstract drawing. It has some properties, it has some edges, it has some corners, and so on. And so the security analysis by Congordon et al. Was basically trying to figure out what is the closest notion of security that the protocol achieves. And so they developed a definition that came very close to what the double ratchet indeed achieves. And they proved that this is actually what they expected to be proven. But the problem of such a definition is, so first of all, it is great. We now have a very good idea or a sense of how secure this protocol is. But this definition is very closely linked to what the double ratchet achieves. So we cannot reuse it for other analyses. There was a second analysis that somewhat made a more abstract, generic idea of what is the double ratchet roughly. And this definition isn't as closely fitted to what the double ratchet is, but it could be used for other messaging protocols as well. And if you look at the definition, you get a pretty good idea of what is a secure continuous key exchange generically. What is the syntax? What is the correctness? What could security mean? How could one adapt security or modify, strengthen security or weaken security requirements, but also guarantees? And this second analysis was by Alvin et al. published at Eurocrypt 2019 under the title The Double Ratchet. Etc. And yeah, as I said, this definition was a little bit more abstract and generic, and therefore helps us to be reused for future security analyses. For example, I currently have a bachelor student who is working with an extended notion or extended version of that definition for a slightly different purpose than this definition was actually meant for. But I would never give that definition of the first paper to any bachelor student, because that first definition is very hard to understand. But still, it was important that this first group of researchers around Catriel Congordon and Kaskremas et al. were doing this first analysis. Okay, there are two even more fine-grained definitions that are pretty hard to identify where to put them, but they are somewhat here even closer, but they follow a different definition approach. So they don't follow our security game-based idea that security definition consists of a game in which an adversary tries to break something, but rather follows a simulation-based approach. The idea is roughly, we give the attacker either the real double ratchet protocol, or we give the attacker an ideal building block. And for this ideal building block, we tell or we specify what should be leaked and what should never be leaked. And it should be hard for the attacker to tell apart whether the attacker sees the ideal thing that for which we describe how it should behave, or the real double ratchet protocol. So basically, it should be hard to distinguish the real protocol with its features and weaknesses from an ideal thing for which we describe very precisely how it behaves. But those two papers are somewhat outside the context of this lecture, because we don't look at simulation-based definition. Both were published at Crypto 2022. Okay. The most important relevance, so now we, from the high level idea and perspective and some background information, we now jump into the construction. And the construction consists of two components. The first component is the asymmetric ratchet. And the asymmetric ratchet is basically a continuous Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And before I draw something, I will just briefly mention also the second component, which is the symmetric ratchet. And this is just basically a parallel key derivation. Okay, so let's look at how this looks in practice. We have Alice and we have Bob. And so Alice, whenever she communicates, so Alice and Bob share some state. They have some information that they establish at the very beginning, and we do not look at the beginning of all of that. We just briefly look at how this protocol works. And so whenever Alice is in the middle of the conversation and sends some information, she will share some G to the A1. So she will send a group element, a Diffie-Hellman share, G to the A1, and whenever she sends something again, so she sends the first message, hey Bob, and then she asks, how are you doing? So she's not capable of writing things in one message. She will not send a G to the A2, instead she will send another G to the A1, or just the same G to the A1. So she will, whenever she sends something at the beginning, she will send G to the A1. Even if she sends a message that is dropped by an attacker, or that is never leaving her phone, or whatever happens to the app, maybe something crashes, she will again send some G to the A1. At some point, Bob may respond. So Bob sends some G to the B1. And this is the moment at which half a round trip is over. And so what Bob is doing here, so first he generates a fresh exponent, B1. And then he also computes a so-called root key. And he computes that root key from the previous version of that root key. And that root key at the beginning is just a symmetric random string. And as part of the computation via a key derivation function, the input is, first of all, the previous version of the root key, but also the Diffie-Hellman key exchange of G to the A1, B1. Okay, that is simple so far. Let's imagine Alice is still sending something. So she's still sending something before she receives the G to the B1. Of course, since nothing changed from her perspective, she will still send her G to the A1. We will learn the reason for that in a second. Probably you know it already because we discussed it in the exercise. The important part is now, again, that from Alice's perspective, something changes here. So she receives the first response to her G to the A1, which is G to the B1. And this G to the B1, as I said, is, again, starting a new round trip from Alice's perspective. And so also Alice computes the new root key, G to the A2, B1. And so whenever she will answer, she will again attach her new Diffie-Hellman share, G to the A2. Let's consider this first message to be dropped again. So she will send another message. But again, she will attach her own current G to the A2. So the next question is, what Diffie-Hellman share is going to be attached with this ciphertext here? So if we just follow that pattern without knowing yet why this pattern works or how it works and what the reason for that is, but if we just follow that pattern here, which Diffie-Hellman share is attached? Yeah, exactly. Why that? Maybe, I don't know. Just look at the pattern. Mm-hmm. Okay, G to the B1. Yes, exactly. So far, so this ciphertext here was sent before G to the A2 was received. And so at the beginning of this sequence here, nothing changed from Alice's from Bob's perspective, only at that moment here something changes, and that moment specifies or declares a new round trip from Bob's perspective. And so Bob will compute a new root key. Now, whenever Bob sends something after that new round trip started, he will attach his second Diffie-Hellman shared G to the B2. Whenever there is a computation, so what you see here is, you see the root key was updated once, G to the A1, B1. Now, on that side here, a new root key is again updated. But what you have to remember is that the same computation of the new root key on that side happens on that side too. So, of course, whenever there is a root key update here, then there is first the same root key update here, and then there is a new root key update. So the root key is actually updated twice. So what I wrote down here is just the new root key update. So first root key update here, root key to new root key with G to the A1, B1. The same would happen here. So Alice would just recompute the same thing that Bob computed earlier, because both of them can compute G to the A1, B1. And both of them know the previous version of the root key. And then once the root key is updated with that computation on Alice's side, Alice will do the second update of the root key with the new exponent A2 that she just computed and that she will attach to her ciphertext that she sends after that. And so once Bob receives that information, G to the A2, he will also compute this root key again with the new Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and after that generate his fresh exponent B2 and do another root key update with the key derivation function. So let's write down some notes on the asymmetric ratchet. So first of all, what we see here is that each of the two parties will resend their current Diffie-Hellman share. And the reason for that is, so what could be the reason for that? I maybe mentioned that already, and maybe you have an idea. Maybe just quickly for everybody to join our focus. What would be the reason why Alice and Bob resend their current Diffie-Hellman share with every ciphertext until the next round trip starts? Exactly. So the primary idea is that, so initially Signal's app was called Redphone and TextSecure, and TextSecure was meant as an app on a smartphone that doesn't have access to the internet continuously, but rather uses SMS. So initially messages were encrypted, so SMS messages were encrypted, and then the encrypted SMS was sent. And probably you remember how SMS worked. I do remember that at New Year's Eve, if you want to celebrate and tell everybody else, yeah, great and a happy new year and so on, and you wanted to send that via SMS, it was pretty likely that the SMS was received maybe noon or afternoon the next day only. And so SMS is an unreliable communication or means of communication in which you cannot trust that things are received in the same order, or maybe things are ever or are lost or something. And for that reason, the protocol needed to make sure that even if a message is lost, the receiver will receive the relevant update. So even if G to the A2 is lost, G to the A2 will eventually be received, because either it will be received or no message at all will be received, because each of the following messages will continue G to the A2 until Alice receives an acknowledgement for that A2, which is basically the next Diffie-Hellman share from Bob. So as long as Bob keeps sending G to the B1, Alice knows, okay, Bob didn't receive any update from my side yet, so I will just continue sending G to the A2, which makes sure that eventually G to the A2 is received, but also it makes sure that once it is received and Bob continues to communicate, then Bob will eventually also be able to send some new Diffie-Hellman update, Diffie-Hellman chair to Alice. And so as long as the communication is not entirely blocked, we know that updates of the Diffie-Hellman chair will eventually happen. And so also eventually we will have some security guarantees that we will specify in a second. So the main reason for that is to handle ciphertext loss. But as we just discussed, this is not a fixed process of always sending the same Diffie-Hellman share. This is restarted, so the Diffie-Hellman key exchange is restarted on every full round trip. And we just saw that if the conversation continues, then round trips naturally occur. And we talked about that also very briefly last week already, that since still the internet is unreliable and Alice and Bob do not know when a message is actually received by the other party, and for that reason messengers, and I think all main messengers, major messengers are doing that, they, once Alice sends a message to Bob and Bob receives that message, Bob will let Alice know that he received that message. So there are received acknowledgements, and these received acknowledgements are sent explicitly. So basically there is a small few bits message that says, okay, Paul, I just received your, so I send a message to Bob, Bob responds and tells me, Paul, I received your message with counter 17. And so I can have the double check mark on my message 17 that tells me via the display that the message was received. Interestingly, if I send something to Bob, Bob immediately responds with an acknowledgement, and that acknowledgement is also encrypted via the double ratchet, then the continuous round trip frequency is pretty high, because I naturally always I naturally always enforce a continuous round trip pattern with Bob if only I send, even if Bob never responds something explicit, but Bob just lets the received acknowledgements be the responses. Okay, so received acknowledgement, round trips occur naturally in natural conversation, but also received acknowledge acknowledgements amplify frequency of round trips. And finally, we have post compromise and forward security due to the asymmetric ratchet, because with a full round trip, we also have a full Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So whenever there is a full round trip, Alice generates a fresh exponent. Bob establishes and samples a fresh exponent. Both of them mix the Diffie-Hellman key exchange of these two exponents into the current form of the root key. And so if there was no exposure between the first sampling of the exponent on Alice's side and the final deletion of the exponent on Bob's side, then due to that Diffie-Hellman key exchange in one round trip, we have security for that round trip. And of course, if there is no corruption or exposure of anything that comes after that, then we have post-compromise security for everything that comes after that, and we have forward security for everything that wasn't corrupted previously. So roughly that is the idea of what the asymmetric ratchet gives us. Now, very briefly on the symmetric ratchet. There is actually not just one symmetric ratchet, but there is one ratchet for each communication direction. So Alice has a symmetric ratchet for all the messages that she sends, and she has a second ratchet for all the messages that she receives. These ratchets start at the beginning of round trips. And the basic idea is that whenever we actually have the update of the root key with some g to the ai bj, then the output of that computation is not only the root key, but also the chain key. We've been talking about the chain key in the exercise already. The chain key is then used, we will see that in a second, to continuously update symmetric keys. And that's the reason why this part here is just the symmetric ratchet. It just uses symmetric cryptographic building blocks, whereas the asymmetric ratchet, naturally, due to the Diffie-Hellman key exchange, uses asymmetric cryptography. The primary idea of the symmetric ratchet is to derive keys for every message. So the actual computation of the symmetric ratchet is to update the chain key and compute a message key from the previous version of the chain key. So we take the chain key, put it into a key derivation function, we obtain the next chain key and a message key. The message key is used for encryption, the chain key is used to compute the next message key. Okay. And the purpose of all of that is to have forward security in round trips. And the level of forward security is very strong here. So whenever a message was encrypted, the message key that can be used to compute or to decrypt that message again is removed immediately, and also the chain key that was used to compute the message key is removed already from the device. And similarly, on the receiver side, whenever things were received already, then the chain key was updated past that moment for the decryption, and the message key was also, or is immediately removed after the decryption. So we basically have something that we could call immediate forward secrecy. Whereas the forward secrecy on the level of the asymmetric ratchet is less immediate, in the sense that, of course, while the round trip is still going on, I can expose the state of Bob or of Alice, and I can compute the Diffie-Hellman key exchange from that. If I still know the root key, I can compute the chain key. And there are still information stored in the state of Alice or of Bob, whoever is exposed, that could leak enough information to compute, if we wouldn't use the symmetric ratchet, to compute and decrypt a received message. The strength of the forward secrecy, that everything that was received already or that was sent already is not decryptable anymore, comes from the symmetric ratchet. All right, this is the basic principle of the double ratchet. The idea is very simple and very elegant. It has strong features for which there are dozens of research papers. But I think to understand the rough idea, this is sufficient. You have some exercises, two exercises, one for last week and one for this / next week, in which you get a better sense for what the double ratchet is doing. But this is actually everything that I would like to tell you about it. Are there any questions? All right, perfect. Then we continue with messaging in groups. So the one example for the first idea of how to build messaging in groups of users is to use pairwise channels. For example, one of those pairwise channels could be the double ratchet, where then the message keys are used with authenticated encryption. Okay, the problem of this idea, for which an old version of Signal, so 5 years ago Signal was using that, it is not using that anymore, but a simple solution would be using pairwise channels, in which we basically have, for example, 5 users, and whenever Alice is sending a message, and let's say Alice is that left user here, Alice will send 4 actual ciphertexts to each of the users. And that means whenever a group is established, we need to establish pairwise channels between all users. This can be expensive. It can be expensive in the sense that the communication overhead is n minus 1. The positive side is we don't have to build new features. We just have pairwise channels already, so everything is fine. And we even inherit the security guarantees. In particular, forward security and post-compromise security. The only real issue that we have, and this is crucial and important, we have to implement some form of membership management. There are different ways to implement membership management in such pairwise channels. The idea that was implemented 7-8 years ago in Signal was as follows. There is some kind of a group secret. And that group secret works like a proof of membership. So basically, whenever Alice was sending something to the group, she was saying, "Hi, I'm a group member. Here is my proof of membership. This is the random string that identifies myself as a member of the group." And whenever Alice wanted to add someone to the group, she would say, "Okay, hi, I'm still a member of the group. Here is my group secret that proves that I'm a member. And I would like to add this user here. This is Charlie. Charlie wants to join the group." And whenever Charlie then wants to send something to the group, she receives something from Alice, that proof of membership, that she can then use to also prove that she's a member of the group. The big problem is once one of the members of a group leaves the group, the proof of membership would need to be updated. And this is basically something like having a group key that allows for updates of membership. And this was non-trivial. And in an old version of Signal, 5, 6, 7 years ago, there was no update of the proof of membership. So whoever was ever a member of the group knew the group membership secret, and so they became basically a permanent member. There is a newer idea for how to implement that, and since this is very complicated and I don't have the time to spend much time on that, but if you're interested in that, take a look at the paper. There is now in Signal implemented a much more sophisticated server-assisted membership protocol. And the guarantees are basically the server doesn't know who is a member of the group. Still, the server makes sure that only members of the group can change the membership. So basically, if I'm a member of the group, then I can prove to the server, "Hey, I'm a member of the group. I would like to change the group." But the server never learns who else is a member of the group. And the server doesn't even need to know who I am. The server can just check with some information stored on the server that I am indeed a member of the group. And I can change the structure of the group. There is some homomorphic encryption involved that is tightly tailored to what is necessary for the Signal use case here. And one of the interesting features, relevant features here, is and was that the pairwise channels can be wrapped in another protocol that hides who is the sender And therefore, these group messages, they just look like normal two-party messages. And so basically the server, whenever a malicious attacker, an attacker looks at the database of all the ciphertexts still in transmission from some Alice to some Bob, the attacker doesn't know which message is a group message and who is the sender of a group or a sender of a message. And this sophisticated server-assisted membership protocol does not leak any information about whether a ciphertext is a group message. So this is really interesting. You should take a look if you're interested. It is a paper by Perrin, Chase, and Zakaria. I hope I noted the name correctly. From CCS, I think 2120. I will need to look that up again. Yeah. So if you just look at the papers of Trevor Perrin and Melissa Chase, you will, I don't know the first name of Zakaria, but yeah, if you look at their papers, you will find the paper on group membership management pretty quickly. Very interesting protocol that makes sure that, first of all, only members can change the group, and also the server never learns who is member of the group, even though the server controls that things are changed consistently. Okay, but the big problem that I mentioned was the communication overhead. For that reason, Signal Today as well as WhatsApp and other protocols use the so-called sender key mechanism. And so the sender key mechanism, again, let's consider 5 users. And so what Alice has is she has a key that she shares with all other members. That is her sender key. And she's the only one who knows that. No, she is the only one who generates that key and uses that key for encryption. All the other members know that key too, and they will just use that key for decrypting ciphertexts sent from Alice. Similarly, let's call this user Bob. Bob has a sender key. And all other users know that sender key of Bob in order to know how to decrypt ciphertexts sent from Bob. And Bob will always encrypt his messages with his own sender key. Okay, so the idea is that that's somewhat tautologic or pretty obvious or clear, but just to make that clear again, the sender uses their own symmetric sender key or let's say own symmetric ratchet to send. And that basically means that there are n symmetric ratchets per group. So each sender key is not a fixed key, but it is rather a symmetric ratchet. The same symmetric ratchet idea that we've just seen for the double ratchet. So we just have a chain key And this chain key is used whenever Alice sends something, she takes her chain key, generates a fresh, or the next chain key as well as the next message key. She takes the message key, encrypts her message to the group, and everybody else has the same chain key, derives from that the next chain key and the message key to decrypt Alice's messages. Whenever Bob sends something to the group, he uses his chain key to derive the next chain key as well as the next message key. Okay, and that means that per user we have one symmetric ratchet that is used for sending, and so each of the receivers or each of the members needs to store one ratchet for themselves for sending, as well as n minus one ratchets for receiving. The interesting part here is that there is almost no information that needs to be attached to the ciphertext for the key establishment. The symmetric ratchet works by itself. The receiver only needs to know which message key is used for encryption and decryption. But there is no key, no cryptographic information that is sent from a sender to the rest of the group. So we could almost say that there is no communication for the key exchange. Or we could just leave out this information here and just say no cryptographic for a key exchange send. And that means there is basically no overhead. It naturally achieves forward secrecy, just as the normal symmetric ratchet, but no post-compromise security. Interestingly, so we're currently, I think I talked about this before, we're currently working with Signal to develop a mechanism to protect the privacy of this sender key mechanism. Because, roughly speaking, if a user wants to anonymize their messages or make sure that no metadata is leaked from a ciphertext that is sent in a two-party setting between Alice and Bob, what Alice would do is she would basically just public key encrypt the ciphertext that she derived from the double ratchet, and she will just send the public key encrypted ciphertext to the server and tell the server, okay, this is the ciphertext for which I don't tell you who I am, but here is the identifier of the receiver, so you can just send it to that receiver and the receiver will know what to do with that. And this gives us some form of sender anonymity, and maybe I will talk about this at the during the last lecture a little bit more. So this works in a two-party setting, but in a group setting, we don't have public key encryption for which we can anonymize the sender. Because the big problem is that if I want to send something to a large group, I would need to encrypt that to each of the receivers, and that again leads to a big communication overhead. So I would need to send an individual ciphertext to each of the receivers, but the sender key mechanism idea is that we have just one component ciphertext, one ciphertext component per group message. There is no overhead. Independent of how large the group is, each ciphertext will consist of one ciphertext. And so, as I said, we're currently trying to develop an anonymizing or a privacy-preserving mechanism to wrap that around the sender key mechanism. And interestingly, as I said, this year only achieves forward secrecy. We would still like to achieve post-compromise security somehow. I don't know how often it really works. We just talked about that with the Signal people recently. But there are updates for post-compromise security. But these updates are basically n messages. So if Alice wants to update her sender key, she will need to send a freshly sampled sender key to all the remaining users via the pairwise channels. So in case Alice wants to do, or any member wants to do an update, we fall back to the pairwise channel situation in which we have a large communication overhead. Okay, so this is not the ideal solution either. The final solution, maybe also not ideal for each context, but still very interesting, is the so-called messaging layer security standard. So as I said, this is a new standard for group messaging. And before I continue, some background information on how that thing was developed. So researchers, we will see the initial idea in a couple of seconds, researchers came up with an idea of how to build group messaging. And then suddenly people from industry, especially from some of the messengers, from smaller messengers, nobody was involved from the WhatsApp side nor from the Signal side, but people from Facebook were involved and also from Cisco. And they thought we would, building such a group messaging protocol and especially standardizing it would be a good idea. Because there was some history about how the new TLS protocol was developed. TLS 1.3 was developed between people from academia, people from industry, and people who really like to write standards. And all these people worked together very, very intensely to come up with a good solution, at least a solution that was analyzed by people who know something about cryptography. So there were a couple of papers that proved that the new TLS standard was secure. And the same happened here. So while MLS was developed, people all over in academia tried to analyze how to make things more efficient, how to make things more secure, how to get rid of some assumptions on the network, for example, how to make sure that people could send simultaneously, concurrently, without losing any efficiency guarantees. And so there were dozens, maybe hundreds of papers trying to contribute to making the message layer security standard a good standard. The underlying idea uses techniques from traditional group key exchange. And these group key exchange papers were developed around the 2000 until 2010 years. And the papers look really, not all the papers, but most of the papers look really bad. It's really hard to understand what is going on there. But the ideas were split between two different concepts. The first one was tree-based Diffie-Hellman key exchange. And this was the one that was useful here in that context. And the other idea was somewhat that I would call circle-based Diffie-Hellman key exchange. The problem why this circle-based Diffie-Hellman key exchange doesn't really work is that it gives us a group key. So this is what we would like to have. We want to have a group key for all the members of the group with which they can encrypt and decrypt messages. The problem of the circle-based one is that updates of group keys only work when every member is online. And that's the big problem why these circle-based or round-based Diffie-Hellman key exchange ideas for group key exchange weren't useful for the setting of messaging in which we can never rely on the network to let everybody be online. The first somewhat rediscovery of this tree-based Diffie-Hellman key exchange for messaging was by Congordon et al. Again, so the same Congordon. Who did with their team an analysis of the signal messaging protocol. The paper was on ends to ends encryption. From 2017. And the basic idea that was derived from that is called ART for asynchronous ratcheting tree. Okay, let's look at the asynchronous ratcheting tree. Which is also sometimes called tree Diffie-Hellman. The important part that I want to mention before I tell you the technical idea is that although we look at trees here, this has nothing to do with HIBE. Okay, so let's consider a group of multiple users. So let's take Alice, Bob, Charlie, Dave, Eve, and some others. And what they do in order to compute or start computing intuitively their group key is that Alice samples an exponent A, Bob samples an exponent B, and the public key of Alice is G to the A, and the public key of Bob is G to the B. The same is done for Charlie, so she has her exponent C, she has her public key G to the C. Dave has an exponent D, and a public key G to the D, Eve has E, and G to the E, and so on and so forth. Now we have a tree structure. And the first level of this tree structure is done by letting Alice share G to the A with Bob, and Bob shares G to the B with Alice, and then the two of them compute the following information. First of all, they compute G to the AB. And G to the AB is now called KAB. Charlie and Dave do the same thing. They exchange G to the C and G to the D. And Eve would do the same thing with her partner. So she would send G to the E and she would get back some G to the F, and so on. And so Charlie and Dave, they compute their KCD as G to the CD. And now the next thing what these two groups would do is they would exchange some public key, AB, and some public key, CD. Okay, any ideas how one could derive this public key for each of the two notes? The primary requirement is of course that Alice needs to be able to compute the secret key for that public key. So this is just a secret key that both Alice and Bob can compute, and they will use that secret key, both of them, to compute the public key. And so either of the two can compute the public key and share that with the others. Alice and Bob do that, and Charlie and Dave do that with their key. And now on the next level, they will jointly compute some KAD, which is public key of AB to the power of KCD, which is the same as public key of CD to the power of KAB. And so the public key of that group again is public key AD is G to the KAD. So on that front here, Eve will do the same with her partner, computing some KEF and some public key EF. Then she would compute on the next level some KEH and some public key EH. And then at the end, for the root of the tree, we again have the key K A H S G to the K A D times K E H, and the public key of the full group is PKAH as G to the KAH. And so the group key is KAH. Okay, this is first of all just the computation. It doesn't tell us anything about why this is the structure, what the properties are, what the features are, why we build a tree, and so on. But I think this is just relevant to digest and think about it for a second. And if you have questions, just please feel free to ask. So this was so far just an idea for group key exchange. Whenever two users were online, they were able to join forces, compute a DiffDM and key exchange, and if they knew the public key from some other group of two users, they could, again, compute the Diffie-Hellman key exchange between both of the tuples, and then with another group of the same size, they could do that again, and so on and so forth. This is just an idea for how to compute a group key. But it doesn't tell us yet how to add users, how to remove users, how to do key updates, because key updates are important. The important features of the alternatives that we looked at before were that we wanted to have forward security and post-compromise security. So how do we achieve that? Key updates. What happens if... a corruption of Charlie happens? And for this, I will just briefly copy that figure here, or that tree. And I will mark all the information that is corrupted by that corruption of Charlie. So first of all, of course, her own exponent C is corrupted. So C is corrupted. That means C offers no security anymore. But if C is corrupted, then also KCD is corrupted. Because just by knowing G to the D, the public key of Dave, and the exponent C of Charlie, we can compute G to the CD. That means public key of CD is also known to the attacker and computable. The same holds then true for the next level. So since KCD is known, KAD is known too. Because the public key of Alice and Bob is publicly known, this is just public information, and KCD is just computable from C if G to the D is known. And G to the D is again a public key. And so finally, if KAD is known, then of course also KAH is known. And that is not really surprising. We want that this is a group key. We want that this group key is computable by everyone. And that means that the information stored by each of the users needs to suffice to compute that key here. And of course, so if one of the users is corrupted, then of course also the key that the group shares is known to the attacker. The only surprising or relevant information now is that none of the secrets or none of the cryptographic keys that are on any of the other paths from a leaf to the root are affected by a corruption. So only secrets that lay on the path from Charlie to the root are affected by a corruption of Charlie. And now the question is, how could Charlie update her secrets? So what Charlie does is she will just compute all the information relevant and share that information that is relevant with everyone, just as if she would join the group from scratch. So she will just compute a fresh exponent C prime, compute the corresponding public key G to the C prime, and share G to the C prime with Dave. Then both of them can compute G to GCD prime, that is G to the C prime D. Both of them can then compute public key CD prime, that is G to the KCD prime. Both of them and all of them, including Alice and Bob, who will receive public key CD prime can compute KAD prime, that is public key of Alice and Bob, to the KCD prime. They can compute the corresponding public key KAD prime as G to the KAD prime. And they can finally, together with the rest of the group, compute the group key update KAH prime as G to the KAD prime times KEH with the corresponding public key PKAH prime, that is G to the KAH. Okay. Now, when Charlie thinks she was corrupted, she will just create and sample a fresh exponent, derive the corresponding Diffie-Hellman share, share the Diffie-Hellman share with Dave. Both of them will then compute their next ancestor's secret key, derive the public key from that, share the public key with their siblings. With their siblings together, they will compute the next higher node's secret KAD prime, derive the public key from that, and then the entire group updates the group key as well as the public key for that, using only the newly generated public key PKAD prime. Okay, so this is necessary for Charlie to update her secrets, and this is very efficient, so we will just see. The corrupted key KAH consisted of G to the KAD times KEH, and this is the same as G to the KAB times KCD times KEH, and finally this is G to the KAB times G to the CD times KEH. Okay, and so this here was the affected exponent, and the only thing that changed is this ciphertext. So now the new KAH prime is almost the same value, it's just G to the KAB times G to the C prime D times KEH. And so the entire computation is now independent of the secret that was corrupted from Charlie's phone or Charlie's device. Charlie generated a fresh exponent C prime, shared the relevant public information with everyone, and we are happy. Now, the interesting information is, what is the communication overhead? So the big problem that we had with pairwise channels was that the overhead is linear in the number of group members. The problem of the sender key mechanism is we only have forward secrecy, and once we want to have post-compromise security, we again have a linear communication overhead. Now, what is the communication overhead here? Maybe the question is too trivial. The communication overhead is log n. Both, this is the communication overhead, but also the number of operations. On Charlie's device. On everybody else's device, it depends on the intersection between their path from the leaf to the root and the path of Charlie from the leaf to the root. So everybody in the right half of that tree here will only have to compute or recompute the group key. Alice has to compute the intersection here, so the second level key as well as the root key, and Dave has to compute basically the entire path except for his own key material, local key material that is individual to them. Okay, so this is the communication and computation overhead. And we just considered or looked at that now from the perspective that we have a static group of 8 users, and the purpose of updates is just to make sure that once a corruption happened, Charlie can recover from that. But there are other properties that we can achieve with this form of updates. And the first form that we can use that for is that we can also control the group membership with that. So first of all, if someone is removed, then we rewrite and update their paths. Because one can consider a user who is removed from the group just as a user who has been corrupted. The guarantee that we want to have for or against a user who was removed from the group is that that user, once it is outside the group, should not have any effect, any harm against the group anymore. And so what Bob, when removing Charlie from the group, could do is Bob could just erase and just update the entire path of Charlie in the name of Charlie without sharing the secret information with Charlie anymore. In order to add someone, of course, there is no free leaf anymore here. So what we would need to do is, first of all, we would need to extend the tree. And the second part is then just again to do an update. Because what we still need to maintain is tree structure. And if a new user joins, we still also want to maintain the invariant that each user knows the secrets on their path and nothing else than that. So if anybody is corrupted, then only the secrets that are computable on their path should be leaked to that user. And that somewhat contradicts what I've just been saying about removing someone. So if, for example, Bob would remove Charlie by erasing all the information and rewriting that information, just performing as if Bob was Charlie and then writing or publishing new information for the path of Charlie that was somewhat break the, or it would directly break the invariant that only each user knows only what is, only knows the secrets on their path. But there are slight variants of that that maintain that invariant to make sure that indeed a corruption will only always affect a single path. The problem that we have here and that we will solve in the next lecture is this relies on non-interactive key exchange. Non-interactive key exchange is the generalization of Diffie-Hellman key exchange, and we know Diffie-Hellman key exchange breaks with post-quantum or with quantum computers, and there are a few alternatives for non-interactive key exchange that allow us to do something, there are alternatives for non-interactive key exchange that are secure against quantum computers, but these constructions and ideas are pretty young. And since they're pretty young, we're not entirely convinced that they are indeed secure against post-quantum or quantum quantum computers. And for that reason, it would make sense to use or to find a different assumption, a different building block than Diffie-Hellman key exchange to build such a tree for tree-based group messaging. Okay. And that is where we begin next week, looking at the Shrikant construction.
What would happen now if we add a ninth member in this example? We have to calculate all the paths for 10 to 11 and so on.
So what we would do if we add a ninth member could be, so one option is we extend the tree here and then add that ninth member here, and so if an 11th member is added, then that tree goes on here, 12th member goes on here, 13th here, 14th here, 15th, and so on. That is one version, but I'm not entirely sure how MLS solved that problem at the end, so how exactly they will structure things, but an alternative would be to grow down here. So basically, if Alice wants to add a new member, she will move here, and the new member is here. And so we just grow one level lower. And I think this is what MLS is doing. In the research literature, we typically assume that there is a mechanism to maintain a tree with minimal depth, in the sense that if Alice wants to add a new user, she would not grow one level lower, but there is some mechanism to make sure that those things are distributed. But this is both a data structure or a tree research question as well as a cryptographic question. But yeah, this is roughly the idea. No. We will talk about the problem of key updates and what happens if multiple users want to update simultaneously next week as well. So we will talk about how to replace the Diffie-Hellman part here with key encapsulation mechanisms, generic key encapsulation mechanisms. But we will also talk about the issue that what happens if Charlie and Eve simultaneously think they were corrupted and so they want to update their path. This will collide here. Even worse, if Bob and Charlie think they were corrupted and they will update their path simultaneously, this will collide here and here. And if we have larger groups than 8 users, then this will happen, that users will simultaneously try to do updates. And there are different approaches how to solve that. And one thing is that one thing one could do is to avoid frequent updates. And there is definitely no update of an entire path with every message that is sent. Yeah. But of course, so what users can still do is they can still do a symmetric ratchet on top of that. So you can still update message keys and chain keys, but you will not update your exponents with every message. But this is also not done in the double ratchet. You just have that once per round trip, but you can't do once per round trip here because that would mean that you just have a slot and only in every 8th slot you can update your exponent. And you would also need to schedule things because it is unclear when a new slot ends. So you would need to make sure that Charlie received the next update from Bob and then she will do the update. So yeah, this is a tricky question. But I also think it is primarily an engineering question to see what are... So there is some literature on trying to simulate how human messaging behavior works and when to do updates and when to schedule updates and whether trees are actually the best idea. So far we use trees, but trees can become pretty problematic once we have frequent removals or frequent collisions of updates or things like that. So depending on how the human behavior actually is, trees might not be the best solution. But right now, we think they are. Mm-hmm. Other questions? All right, then thank you very much for your attention. And next week, we talk about TreeCam.